Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. So news from the class, let's see. There may be an issue with some of your concept ones that were marked late. The TA may not pick them up on Friday after walk at 15. Once I understand exactly what happened, I'll get back to you on that. So some of you may have turned it in on and had it come back marked late. I'll try to come closer on that. Next week, September 25 and 27, we will actually not be meeting here for lecture at all. Instead, I will be posting slides that are a bit neater and more detailed and annotated and with page numbers. And then I will give you audio recordings of those, referring to all that stuff, so you should be able to follow along in a much better way than you can typically now with audio, for example. You can listen to it in your PJs or whatever. Have a beer. I don't care. But listen. I will assume it was just like we had lecture here. I will not review it when I'm back on the following Tuesday. Alright. I will be in touch via email. I'll be in Japan, so there might be a little lag between when you email me and when I can answer. But the other thing is, I should have access to an electronic copy of the textbook, but if you have a specific question about a problem, it's probably easier if you send me the problem as well and ask me a detailed question. So, problem set 4, because we won't be meeting in here, just put it in the locker. I'll tell the PAs to keep the same timing and everything, so just get it in Friday night. Workshops will run normally, and if you have questions on the lecture material or whatever, email me and I will try to answer them. Okay? Any questions about that stuff? Okay, so just a heads up, especially since I won't be here next week to tell you this in person, we do have exam 1 coming up 2 weeks from Thursday. It's going to cover material for next week's workshop and the problem set that you will hand in a week from Thursday. Okay, so it'll be through the start of Newton's Law, but we will not be getting deeply in Newton's Law, but definitely do some Newton's Law problems. I won't know until I get there exactly where I'll break in terms of the lecture. I tend to try to cut the material off before the exam, about a week before the exam or a little bit more. So the sad part about that is Tuesday before the exam, we'll be doing stuff that isn't on the exam. But I'll get you on that later, so don't just completely ignore it. Just in terms of how we run things, this particular exam will be 8 a.m. here on that Thursday, and we will have lecture normally, and that may seem a little painful, and I'm sorry about that, but it's actually allowing us to do more per semester, so we're going to do that. I do have past exams completely available online. You don't have to go to your fraternity for a file. It's already online. I have versions with and without solutions that you can see. In fact, so if you come to me and say, "Can I, give us a practice exam?" They're there. Now, the trick with that is the synchronization may vary a little bit from term to term, so you have to use some care for whether the problem is relevant or not. Right? Don't go to exam 3 if you think you're going to have any idea what's on that exam. So usually go with exam 1. There have been semesters when I avoid having 4 exams during the semester, so the amount of material covered would be different. Final exams are fair game, but of course they cover the whole semester, so you have to be really careful with problems you pick and choose from that. Okay? And if you have particular questions as to whether something's relevant, I can try to answer, but might not happen immediately. I will allow you to use calculators. I totally de-emphasize the memorization of formulas, and I absolutely get really pissed off when I see high school students spending all their time memorizing formulas. So We're just not doing that. If you're spending your time fretting about memorizing formulas, you are totally off base on how to study this stuff, okay? It's not about that. You need to know what goes into them, how they're gotten, and how to use them. Spend your time doing problems. I had a student come up to me once after completely getting knocked around on one of the exams and saying, but I think I understand what you're saying in the lecture. I said, that's good, but of course, I'm telling you a careful story, so I hope that I can make it so it's understandable. And then I read every chapter 7 times. Okay, that seemed a bit extreme to me. I don't know about you. Obviously, it wasn't. You all must be doing it 7 times. That's pretty good. So I then said, how about the homework? Are you doing homework? Oh, no. After I read the chapter 7 times, I think I've already spent enough time on it, and I think I understand it. So that was an easy one. It's like, well, that's why you're getting killed. Maybe read the chapter twice, and then do all the problems. You know? So there's a way to study and there's a way not to study. I de-emphasize memorizing the formulas. You're welcome to bring a calculator. You probably won't need it very much. I mean, you might do a little numerical calculation, but it's not about really doing the math so much. Generally, it's about understanding and setting things up conceptually. Okay, that's getting to the right equations, and who'll be grading. The grading will be emphasizing, do you understand the problem? Do you understand the physics and how to set it up? And if you make an algebraic mistake at the end and trying to calculate things a little bit, you're not going to lose much in the way of points there. Okay, so we're going to de-emphasize. We will leave headroom for somebody who does it perfectly, but you're not going to lose a lot for that. So along this line, I will basically come up with a formula sheet that has any equation that I can imagine you need. And you're welcome to use, for this exam, one side of an 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper, not topologically enhanced. Meaning, I don't want to come and see lots of flats on it to increase surface area. You laugh like that wouldn't happen. I should have taken a picture of it. I mean, somebody took this one sheet at that time because they had both sides. And they must have had, you know, 50 flats on this. And then there are the people who basically go to a copy machine and reduce each page of the text, okay? And then get this put on a sheet, right? If you're doing that, my suggestion is that your time is better spent other ways than preparing for the exam. If you are using this sheet to simply write down something that you sometimes are getting confused about, or you just feel comfortable having it there because you're afraid you'll forget it, then that's good. If you want to put an example problem on there because you are pretty sure that I would give you such a thing and you've been having trouble with that type of problem, fine. If you pick exactly the problem that I put on there, fine. That means you studied and you actually figured out what was important enough to have on there. Okay? So I'm okay with that. You can put anything you want on that one side of the 11 sheet of paper. You get further into that thing, you have other sides. Right now, it's fine. 1 or 2 days before the exam, I will put aside an hour and a half. It will be some time. I'm sure you will not all be able to make it, but we'll try to find the time for most of you to make it. And we'll have a Q&A session. And I don't call it a review session because I'm not going to sit there and lecture at you. I've been doing plenty of that. But I will try to respond to any question you have for me at that point. Fully. By that point, I hope I have the exam made out. Part of why I don't want to do a review session is because I don't know quite how I can do that fairly by pulling you away or towards specific things I might have on the test. But I will answer in full anything you ask for that hour and a half. Okay, so I'll try to set that up. And okay, any questions on that? Okay. So last time, you know, once in a while, sometimes I'll give a lecture and I feel pretty good about it, and sometimes I give a lecture and I walk out and go, wow, that sucks. So Last time was a tough one. Sorry about that. I just felt slow. I'm not quite sure. So I got all the, I don't know, it was just slow. So what we were doing was we were looking at vectors. We went through a number of rules about how to deal with these strange mathematical beasts called vectors, which whether you like it or not, and whether you see the reason for it or not, get real good at them, because there are really good reasons for them that I hope I've convinced you about by the time we get very far in the course, and certainly by the time we get to the end. But to do this analysis, we really have to use vectors for three-dimensional sorts of things. And the way that we do that is we take a vector that might be out, in this case that's only in two dimensions, it might be sitting out in some arbitrary place in two dimensions, which we can define very clearly. It has a magnitude and it has an angle that's specified, say in this case with respect to the positive y-axis. So that information is important. Also, these vectors have their components. So it has a number in the x and the y, which that pair of numbers would represent that vector in the same way that the triplet of numbers would be a vector in three dimensions. So what we want to do, because it's hard to deal with these vectors directly, we looked at the graphical way of adding them, and that's okay if you have a graphing table, but it's not going to be so easy to do on a test. What you do is you take these vectors and you break them into components along what we would call vertical axes of the problem, along the orthogonal axes, the things that are 90 degrees to each other, okay? And in this case, it's x and y. And so you have to break them up. So remember that how vectors add graphically. If I look at the, if I take the x piece of this vector b and I create a vector along x that is represented by just that number, so it's something that has a magnitude and it's in the direction of that, so this would be some negative x number, you can define this vector b sub x. I can take this and move it up to where you have this almost invisible green thing that's supposed to be what that is, but move. And I can add it to the analogous beast for the y, and now you can see I can graphically add these two vectors at 90 degrees, and I get vector b. Vector b basically is made up of those two components. It's a way to think about it. Analytically, to get that, you use these rules, and remember your trig here. There will be some angle defined, in this case it's theta, and you use the sines or cosines appropriately as to what you have. So b and the y is going to be the magnitude of b, which is the hypotenuse, times the adjacent side, which is the magnitude b over cosine theta is going to be the adjacent side of the hypotenuse of the b. And so that basically gives you this formula for the x you would use that one. And so you get these components, and when you take all the vectors in the problem that are going off in all these different directions, and you break them into components along those orthogonal directions, you then have one-dimensional problems. It's now easy to add vectors if they're all along one line. If they're headed in this way, you just add the magnitudes together. If they're headed opposite ways, you subtract them, okay? And you get a number. And that then represents the component of the final vector along that axis. And you have the same for the other axis, and then you recombine those using the same kind of logic, okay? So that's the basic idea of how we'll do analysis. And like I say, I think it sort of seems ridiculous when you first see it, but you get used to doing it very quickly, and then you find yourself doing it automatically. But by all means, make sure you understand the angle and the sines and the cosines, and don't just start pulling that out of thin air because you saw some example problem where they use the sine. Okay, you've got to think your way through where the angle is and the sine and cosine. So in general three-dimensional motion, the world is then described by vectors. So we can imagine having some object like a ball sailing through the air, okay? And we can define a coordinate system if you wish. Being three dimensions, I've written two here. And we can describe the position of that ball as a function of time by a vector, which I'm calling s here, okay? And it is a function of time. So if the ball is flying along like this, and my shoulder is sort of the origin, then my finger becomes the vector that describes where it is as a function of time, if you want to think of it that way. So this is changing in direction and magnitude potentially as a function of time. In addition, this ball might have a velocity. It might have an acceleration. Those also are vectors. They might be in totally different directions. Okay? So to describe this motion as a function of time, you really need to know these things. And they are related. Remember that the velocity is the time derivative of the position, and acceleration is the time derivative of the velocity. So if you know that function as a function of time, if you know all those things, you can take the derivative to get this and the derivative of that to get this. Okay. Again, this can be arbitrarily complex. If you want to know something's function of time, you resolve the vectors into long into three dimensions. You do your algebra there, then you recombine them. Okay. So that's how it's done. So just to belabor the point a little bit about the relationship here, remember that these things are related. They're not just completely arbitrary functions. Okay, so when I look now at something like two-dimensional motion, what you want to do is understand what's happening with those kinematic variables, the vectors describing them, as a function of time in motion. So in this case, I'm not showing you the S vector that basically represents its position. And I'm also not showing you the acceleration vector, but this would be something where I have a ball and I just toss it here near the surface of the Earth. And so it moves in something like this parabola. And let's think about it a little bit, okay? If I start to toss it up at some angle theta with respect to the horizontal, right? It's usually defined that way, so when you get used to doing these problems, you're going to start getting used to using sines or something because that angle is defined that way. But every equation you have that has a sine in it, if I give you a problem and I define the angle with the y-axis instead of the x-axis, they should be cosine. Right. And you need to get that. So don't just automatically pull out sine. Think your way through that. At any rate, I start out with an initial condition where it just leaves my hand, and when it does, it's moving at an angle theta with respect to the x-axis. This is the initial velocity vector. It is always tangential to the path, right? This is basically a trace of the tip of the S vector, where the ball is going. And the velocity vector will at all points be tangent to that. So as the ball moves, you see the velocity vector stays tangent to the motion. So initially I start out in this way, so I'll have an initial y velocity and an initial x velocity. And now you have to ask what's going to happen in each dimension separately in order to understand the motion. There is no acceleration along the x direction if we neglect air friction, air resistance. We're at the surface of the Earth, so the Earth is pulling down. So there is an acceleration downward in the y direction. So the x component doesn't change. There's no acceleration. The acceleration is zero, which is a constant. So you can use constant acceleration equations. But it's zero, so the velocity stays fixed. So this component never changes as you go through the whole problem. Okay? This component, however, because you have acceleration in the y, it's down. This initial velocity is up. So you may have an acceleration down, but you're still moving up. It's just your velocity going up is decreasing. So this vector decreases in size. Eventually it reaches the top of the motion, which is defined as where that velocity vector is literally zero. And then, because the acceleration stays down and it is constant going down, that velocity vector will begin to grow headed downward. That is, the ball starts to move downward. So the y motion is just up and then down like that, getting increasingly fast. The x motion is just a constant velocity this way, and you just superimpose the two to get the three dimensions. Okay? So that's how you want to sort of try to think about multidimensional motion. Because the acceleration is zero in the horizontal direction. But in the vertical direction, that's not true. Okay, so I put a link up on your website. You may want to play with this. There's a funky applet which sort of illustrates some of these things. So let's see what happens. You can sort of see how the different velocity vectors are acting as it moves. Okay, so this is sort of just a graphical thing. Watch it at the top of its motion. Right at the top, that the vector that's vertical is zero. Okay, that's what defines it as being. And it's getting bigger and bigger going down because it's accelerating going downward. So, okay? You're welcome to play with that at your leisure on the class website. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is a demo. So for you animal lovers, today we're going to shoot a monkey. So what I have is a gun with a laser sight. I have a monkey that has an implanted bottle cap on his head. It's a very sophisticated lab. And the way this is set up is that when the trigger is pulled, the monkey drops. Okay? So the monkey begins to fall at the very moment you pull the trigger. So think of it as a... Well, it wouldn't work this way. I can pull it faster. But you think of it as a monkey getting scared when it hears the sound of the trigger being pulled. Or the gun going off. Okay, so let's say the monkey sees the muzzle flash and then lets go. That would do it, because that's very bad. Anyway, so I can tell that didn't bother you, that particular. So that's the deal. So now I have a question for you. Okay, so we have our monkey, and I'm not a good monkey drawer, so we'll just put the tail on. Okay. And so we have the monkey, and the monkey is holding on to some branch. Alright? And now you are over here with your semi-automatic assault rifle. Because you surely want to make sure you get that monkey. And now the question that I have for you is, given the physical situation that we have, okay, I would like you not to share it with your neighbor right now, but we're going to do one of these computer problems so you can see it. I want you to tell me where you would aim with that gun in order to hit the monkey. Okay? So, would you aim up here? I think we're doing letters, so we'll call this A. Would you aim right here? B. Would you aim maybe here? C. Or would you aim, say, here? D. Alright, so I want you to think for a moment and decide which letter that you think it should be. And now let's see what you think, okay? So A, B, C, D. So join the class with your clicker thingy. Turn the unit on. The unit will show that it's searching for a class to join. Wait until it shows join. On the screen that is displayed by your instructor, there are channels. It's just number one is the numeric. So press one at that point, and that's when you should join. So we have 40. I'd really like to get it closer to 100 if we could do that. So try to bring your device here for class. Anyway, so let's go ahead and do this. So you have in your mind which one you think it should be. And let's see. Okay, now if you have your clicker, press the A, B, C, or D. C. Come do it.
All right.
somebody wanted to aim at it. Why? Why did that work?
They have the same downward acceleration. They're going to fall at the same rate.
Yeah, I mean, you're used to leading things. I mean, if you're playing baseball or football, right, the quarterback will throw the ball way out in front of the person running. That's sort of true. So here you might naively think you do that, but there's a difference. In the football field, the person does have gravity acting on them, but they also have ground holding them up. So they're not accelerating down with the football, if you think of it that way. So you've got gravity acting on the football, so you have to lead it so it sort of comes into the person. Here, you've got the downward piece of acceleration is acting during the same time period on both of them. We haven't gotten there yet, but the mass doesn't matter. The acceleration is the acceleration. And so what happens is that the downward component of each is the same. Okay, and the only thing that's different is this one also has a horizontal component. And so if you aim at it, it will hit. Okay? It's just an illustration of sort of this concept I'm talking about. Okay, so I'm not going to let you bring guns into the exams. So you're going to be stuck doing analytical problems. So let's do one of these. Let us imagine that it's a prettier day than we have today. And we're sitting out having a picnic, okay? So all sorts of good blue food there, right? So we're having a picnic, and because we're near the lake, we have a seagull flying by, and the seagull is moving at 5 meters per second, and the seagull is high above the ground. The picnic table is 1 meter above the ground. And the seagull is going to do what seagulls do at a distance of 15 meters. So not exactly the scale here. So you're having this nice picnic, and the seagull goes and says, ooh, a picnic. And right here, let's lose. And you have projectile motion going on here, right? So then the question is, does the bird ruin the picnic? And we'll define the bird ruining the picnic by this table is 1 meter wide. So the real question is, is the bird excrement land on the table? Okay? You want a real life example? We're going to do it. All right, so it's now just a projectile problem, and you've been given the initial conditions, basically. All right? And I think one thing that people have a misapprehension, misunderstanding of, and you'll see this on MCATs and things like that. If a plane is flying and it lets go, right, if the plane is stopped, that goes straight down. If the plane is flying, note it didn't go straight down, it went like that, okay? Why? Because you have that initial hard drive velocity of the plane, that stays with us. In the real world, you do have air friction. So if you turn into a bombardier for the Air Force, you're going to have to take that into account. But in our world, we're going to ignore that. So what you see is the velocity that's horizontal that never changes, while the velocity downward now builds and accelerates. Those two components give you the three-dimensional path, and that's what you reconstruct. So how would you go about doing the problem? What really defines whether the bird bombs the table or not? Yeah, so it's these two things all folded together. You have the whatever, you have it moving this way at the same time it's falling. So you can use the vertical information to figure out how long it takes for something to fall from this height down to a height of 1 meter. So that defines when it is high enough that it would hit the table. Then you can ask, given that amount of time, where are you horizontally? And if you are anywhere within this meter horizontally, okay, so if you are within 16, then 15 and 16 meters, then you hit the table, right? That's the concept of the problem. You really have to have that kind of picture of what's going on before you jump into the problem. I've definitely known students who were fine at manipulating equations, and they were really anxious to jump into using the first equation they saw, the first equation that popped in their head. Constant acceleration motion. I know those four equations. Let's use this one. And they jump into it without actually thinking their way through the problem. And that's often the rub. Sometimes it's because of language, okay? You have to pick up on the clues in the written problem. And sometimes it's misunderstanding or whatever, but it is that safe. You need to make a clear picture of what you think is going to happen. As the problems get more complex, you may have less of a clear picture, and you have to play a little bit with the problem before that picture is sort of developed. But anyway, try to come up with such a concept before you start calculating things. And let's look at the two dimensions separately. In the y direction, I'm going to define positive as up, just because I have a 50-50 shot of defining it one way or the other. I'm going to choose it as up. That means A in the Y, we don't think of it as a vector because it's now a one-dimensional problem. We just consider the Y. So I have acceleration in the Y that is a number, which is negative because I've defined positive as up. So this will be equal to minus 9.8 meters per second squared. How do I know that? Well, we'll calculate it and everything that just happens to be the acceleration due to gravity of the surface of the Earth. The initial velocity in the Y, because the bird is flying horizontally, the initial velocity is zero. Y0 is equal to plus 10 if I define Y equals 0 here at the ground. And the final position that I want to test, given this idea of I want to know if it hits the table or not, is I want to know at what point it's 1 meter above the ground. So I set Y equal to plus 1. Then in the X direction, let's define this as x equals 0, and positive x is to the right. A in the x is equal to 0. B0 in the x is equal to the 5 meters per second, which is the speed of the seagull. X0 I'll define as 0, because that will be the point that I'll call 0 in the drawing. And then the question is, what is x? And if at between 15 and 16 meters, then the table gets set. Okay? So now you get to look at your constant acceleration equations, because they'll be valid on both of these. And you may flail about a little bit with that. In time, you'll sort of begin to get better at looking and seeing which equation might get you further. You will have noticed already in your homework, if not, you will get tangled up in quadratics at times. Sometimes you can avoid the quadratic, you end up doing two of the equations instead. I don't know. Don't sweat it too much. Do get used to doing quadratics, but some of these things fall out a little more simply if you have one of the equations. But all four equations are valid, so long as you stay consistent in how you choose your signs and everything, you should eventually stumble into what you need. But in this case, let's say y is equal to y0 plus v0 and yt plus 1/2 at squared. So we have 1 meter equal to 10 meters plus 0, because v0 and y is 0, minus 1/2 times 9.8 t squared. So t ends up being the square root of 18 over 9.8, or t is equal to 1.4 seconds. You can check in the algebra on time. For x is equal to x0 plus v0 being x, t, remember these are one-dimensional equations, plus 1/2 the acceleration in the x times t squared. The acceleration in the x is 0, so this term is 0. You've defined the position where you start in x to be 0, so this term is 0. So we have just that v0 in the x is equal to, we have that x is equal to v0 x times t. And so when we want to solve for the time here, when you reach a height of 1 meter, because that's what you want to know. You want to find x when that is true. So you get that x is equal to 5 meters per second times the time of 1.4 seconds, or x is equal to 7 meters, and the table is not good. Hooray! Okay. Any questions on that?
Why is the initial velocity the y0?
Because, and I would have said it very explicitly in the exam problem, but it's because the bird is moving horizontally anyway. I could give you the same problem and give the bird an angle, in which case you'd have initial y velocity. Everything would be the same, except you'd have to take that initial y velocity into account. Okay? Else? That was a good question. And in fact, that's the kind of thing that when you're doing these types of problems, you may find yourself with a question just like that. And then you have to look at the problem very carefully to see if it's truly specified or not. And I was a little loose in specifying that up here. When I make out exam problems, I try to be very careful. But when we're in an exam and you have something, if you have a question like that, ask. Yes.
So an exam question could be, you'll give us an angle and then we'll have to figure out the x to y, or we'll have to figure out the y.
Or I'll tell you, the bird's flying like this and it hit the thing, so what was the angle? Or, it could be any sort of thing. That's one of the reasons why I don't care if you copy the book, because there's an infinite variety of problems. When I was in, quantum field theory 4 in graduate school, we were allowed to have a sheet to prepare for our class. And in that class, there were probably only about 6 problems that mortal humans can solve on. Right? So, here's how you get through grad school. I went to the bookstore and bought this, 7 or 8 leading quantum mechanics textbooks. Page through them, wrote down on my sheet those 5 or 6 mortal problems that people can actually solve. And sure enough, One of them was verbatim on the exam, out of three problems, right? And, you know, the other is pieces of it wrong. So you can get away with that. You're not so lucky in this class, because there's an infinite number of ways that I can juggle things around. That's one of the reasons why students that I have known in high school who I knew very well, but have to remain nameless here, I have known at least one of them to be extraordinarily frustrated with physics and basically say to me, just tell me the easy way to do this, right? And sad news is the easy way is to actually understand what's going on. And there is no easy way. So you have to pay attention to what it is. You can't memorize the formulas and regurgitate or anything like that. It just doesn't work that way. So okay. As you can see, we're going to talk a lot about things falling near the surface of the Earth, so I think we need to spend a little bit of time talking about that. And it's sort of this a priori fact that things fall, okay? And we're going to get into Newton's law next time, but basically, things accelerate if you have a force. So this is something which is known as Newton's second law, and I'll get more into Newton's laws. But basically, Newton says that if you exert a, this is sort of the definition, if you exert a force on something, it will cause an acceleration that is inversely proportional to the mass. Okay? And this again, this is sort of defines a couple of things. The mass here is something that we call inertial mass. This is the intuition I've been trying to begin to give you, that you have constant acceleration if the force is constant along that direction, for example. This is a vector problem, so whatever direction the net force on an object is, that would be the net direction, that would be the direction of acceleration, regardless of the motion otherwise. Okay? And this, I hope, will make intuitive sense to you, right? If you take a guy like me, I'm not going to walk out on the football field and be a running back because I have a very small mass. And when I run into some big guy who exerts a force on me, I get a massive acceleration, right? So my brain goes squash and I'm in bad shape. So if I'm a really big guy, then it's a little bit different. If you're pushing a car, right, would you rather push a little Volkswagen or a huge Cadillac? If you're in a frictionless situation, you want to push the little car because then for relative little force you get acceleration. But if it's a huge thing, you can push really hard, you can get this thing barely moving. So I hope the intuition is there. The intuition does get screwed up by lots of other forces in nature, right? If you have a big box on the floor, this is sort of true, but if you start pushing it, it also stops because you have friction involved. So there are other forces besides just you pushing it. So we're really going to get into this ad nauseum, but I hope that at some level this kind of thing makes sense to you. Independently, there are natural forces that exist, and one of them we call the force of gravitation. And Isaac Newton came up with something called his universal law of gravitation. And you can actually go into a lab and determine this. But basically, the idea is that if you have some mass, call it M1, and you have some other mass, which we'll call M2, separated by a distance r, then this law of gravitation tells us there will be a force between them, which happens to be attractive, which is equal to, it depends on their masses. So big masses are attracted to each other more than little masses. It is inversely proportional to the distance between them. So if they are twice as far apart, the force is four times smaller. And we have to set a scale. So we have to pick units, and once we have units, so we might choose, say, kilograms and meters, and then we go and we measure the force in some unit, and then we have to have a constant that makes everything work, which basically sets the scale of the force. And so that is a constant called G, big G. And it's a number, okay? And it would be a number that would have to have the units. We'll get into it, but the units of force we actually call newtons in an MKS system. Kilograms, kilograms, meters squared. So this would have to be something that has the units that would give you newtons if you multiply it by kilograms squared or meters squared. So it's going to be newtons per meter squared per kilogram squared. Sort of a weird thing. But you can actually go out and maybe at some point I'll show you an example, but you could actually, and this is done, you can take masses on a bar that are held by a very stiff wire. And if you take it and you rotate it a little bit, it'll do this. Okay, it'll just sort of go back and forth. And if you were to pull on one of these balls with some sort of magnet or something, that would actually adjust the angle and the timing of this thing. So you can measure forces on these balls by looking at the timing of this thing rotating. So then what you can do is take other masses and put them nearby at different distances from this thing. And it will adjust the timing. From that, you can actually extract this force. So you can use different masses and different distances and determine this law and curve. Okay? So this did not come down from a mountain scribbled on a rock. Okay? People actually go and figure this stuff out. Why does it have to be this way? I don't know. This is science. Okay, this turns out to be how it is. Is this the only way we do gravity? No. Everything we do in this course, we're going to do Newtonian gravity, which is this law. And it works for anything you'll ever have to deal with, unless you do very particular things. Okay? But it is, Einstein did a theory of general relativity. It has a completely different conceptual point of view of what gravity is. And it is more accurate. It works better for large distances. If you really want to understand the planet Mercury's orbit, you better use general relativity and not Newtonian physics. Newtonian physics will actually lead to errors in time. So NASA uses relativity, okay, most of the time. But if you're just lobbing a shell to hit some other ship, or you're calculating where baseball's going to land, you're fine with Newtonian gravity. So, there are other concepts of gravity that don't have to do with Einstein. So we may talk a bit more of that, but just sort of bear that in mind. This is the Newtonian law of gravity, and what I wanted to do with this is, instead of getting too hung up on just this law, which we'll talk about more in general later, what I want to do is look at a special case. So imagine that we have here on Earth, right? So here we are. Okay, perfect. So then you have something on the surface of the Earth. What's going on? And so we want to look at a very special case. special case, we actually have a radius of the Earth, which is VR. Which happens to be 6.38 times 10 to the 6 meters. G, I've told you, is a constant, and this is true for all Newtonian problems. So we call this the gravitational constant. And that's equal to 6.67 times 10 to the minus 11, a quantity called newtons. So we measure force in units of newtons. You're actually used to measuring forces in units of pounds. I mean, that's sort of what the American English system is. But an MKS is measured in newtons. So this would be newtons meter squared per kilogram squared to make the units all work out. And we also need the mass of the Earth equal to 5.97 times 10 to the 24 kilograms. Okay. So in this special case where we're sitting on Earth, there's a fact that I'm going to gloss over a little bit here. Probably will continue to gloss over throughout your class. But you can assume that the mass of a symmetric object like this is concentrated. So we're not going to gloss over it. We're actually going to calculate it. It'll be about two-thirds of the way through the semester. But you can assume that the mass of the Earth is all concentrated at a point that is at the center of the Earth for this type of problem. And then we have an object which is roughly near the surface of the Earth. So this R sub E is the distance between them. This is the mass of the object, and this is the mass of the Earth. And so now if we use Newton's laws, we get that the force on this object at the on the surface of the Earth is equal to G times the mass of the Earth times the mass of the object divided by the radius of the Earth squared. Okay? And what you want to see is that this constant describes gravity. It's a universal thing. You measure it once and that would be the same forever no matter where you are. This is the mass of the Earth, which, as far as we know, is a fixed number that you measure in the problem. This is the radius of the Earth. It may vary a tiny bit because the Earth isn't a perfect sphere, but we have some average number, and that's good enough. These are all fixed constants, okay? So we group them together into a single number, which we define as g, little g, okay? And if we go back to Newton's law earlier, he said that F is equal to M times A. This is a vector equation, but it's also true if I look at it just in magnitudes. Okay? So, F, M times a quantity. F, M times a quantity. So this thing, this G, represents the acceleration that comes from the force of the Earth pulling on an object due to the force of gravity. Okay? So that's where we call this the acceleration due to the force of gravity. If you go and measure it, it's 9.8 roughly meters per second squared. And in fact, if you look at these quantities and you put in the units, you'll find that you get units of meters per second squared. And if you calculate those numbers, you get 9.8. So. One thing that's sort of interesting in this, to somebody like me, is that if you look at this, we have a concept of something which is inertial mass. So that is sort of the reluctance to be accelerated by something, right? It's really hard to shove somebody big versus somebody small. Okay? Here we have a quantity which we call mass. And it's a description of a fundamental force in nature. You could use another word, okay? But it's the same thing insofar as we know. It isn't completely obvious to me why it has to be the same thing, but it turns out to be inertial mass and gravitational mass are actually two fundamentally different concepts, but it turns out that they are the same beast. So, something cool for physics geeks to think about. Okay, so there's some subtleties in all this. What we call weight is what you mean when you say it is the magnitude of the force of gravity due to Earth, Earth's gravitational attraction. Near the surface of the Earth. So your weight is equal to this F, which is mg. Okay, that's how we define weight. It's not a vector, it's a magnitude. But it is defined very specifically at Earth. And that definition comes in when you use g of 9.8 meters per second squared. Why? Because g contains, little g contains the mass of the Earth and the radius of the Earth. So it is very specific to the surface of the Earth. If you go to the moon, you have to talk about your weight on the moon. If you take a rock in your hand at the moon, and you hold it out and you let it go, what happens? It falls in spite of the fact there's a vacuum. There's a common misunderstanding that gravity stops at the edge of the atmosphere. It doesn't. Gravity keeps going just fine. Okay, even if you have no air. So if you are on the moon and you let that rock go, it does not just hang there and stay. It falls. But it falls much more slowly than it does on Earth. The acceleration is less because if you want to calculate your weight on the moon, then the weight on the moon, you have to calculate this little g on the moon. So you go back up and you look at how you got this g. Right, how you got this g, and you see that it's, instead of mass of the Earth, you put mass of the moon, instead of radius of the Earth, you put the radius of the moon. Then your weight is equal to your mass times g times the mass of the moon over the radius of the moon squared. And I think that's like about 1/6. It turns out to be about 1/6 of Earth's gravity. 1/6 times little g. Little g is little g on the Earth. It is defined to be. That's what it always is. Okay. If you're going to calculate little g on the moon, you better make a subscript. Or else you, in this case, for example, I use g on the Earth, but I put a fraction in front of it so that you get the right number. And I believe that that's roughly 1/6. I'm going to calculate it out. Okay, so one of the issues we have to deal with really happens to be units. And I'm not going to go too hard about units in this class. But you should be aware of different systems of units, and you should be extremely, if you're into the English system, you better always pay attention to English, because most of the rest of the scientific world is always going to be using MKS. Okay. If you're dealing with U.S. engineers, and I've already said this to you once, if you're dealing with U.S. engineers and U.S. industry, some of it is really still hung up on the English system. So you have to be really careful when you're ordering things, okay? And make sure that you all understand what units you're talking about. But kinds of systems that are common of units. There's the MKS system, which is what we will use primarily. And in that system, the unit of force is called a newton. The unit of mass is called a kilogram. And the unit of acceleration is in meters per second squared. There is another very common system that you'll see, depending on what physics book you pick up. It turns out that in some theorists, when they're doing physics, really prefer the CBS system. And I think it does simplify some of the equations. If they've written a general physics textbook that you'll be picking up, just throw it away and get a different one, because it'll just be confusing. And it also means it's probably written by somebody who's so involved in their theoretical physics that my guess is it's probably not that good a textbook for you anyway. Okay? So, but you may see it. It's called the CGS system. And from the point of view of the forces and things, the measurement of mass is in grams. The measurement of distance is in centimeters. Time is the same. And force is in something called dynes. And if you have something in one of these systems, it's easy enough to convert it to the other. You can Google it and figure out what the conversion factor is. One of the reasons I want to bring this up, though, is to make the point about the English system, because that's what really works its way into the language around us. In the English system, units of force you're used to, and that is called the pound. The unit of acceleration, distance is in feet in the British system. Per second squared is the acceleration. And just so you know that here, G is 32 feet per second squared. The weird one, which you may not have heard of before, and why I'm doing this in part, is the unit of mass in the English system. I think when you use language, you would sort of think of it in pounds, and that's how you would normally say. But it's not. The unit, remember that force is equal to mass times acceleration, and force and mass are not the same beats, okay? So if the unit of force is in pounds, the unit of mass actually has to be different. And it turns out it's in a unit called slug. Go figure. So if you want to, if somebody says, well, your mass, you need to get the answer in slug, which is your weight in pounds, that serves here, divided by 32 per second squared. If your engineering friends do shots and start talking about slugs and laughing, now you know why, okay? All right, so we'll see you Thursday.
I think I'm going to try setting up the Christmas to see if this works. I don't think it did. I don't want to miss attendance.
Yep.